It's Wednesday, the 20th of August, 2025, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast, with David Taylor and Phil Bishop reviewing some of the industry news from the past 2 weeks. And we're going to be talking about recruitment and training shortly, Phil, always a lively topic of discussion in the construction industry. But we're also about to publish our annual roundup of the top 100 construction firms. So I thought we could take a look at some of the topics that that's thrown up as well.
There's always a lot of interest in that, isn't there? Everyone, as we were being told last month when we had Susanna from Build UK on, she was saying, everyone loves the table except when they're at the bottom.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose I could summarise the... Well, it's always a bit of a curate's egg, isn't it, the top 100? Because you look at it and you think, oh, that's good. Yeah, that looks fine. And you scan down the table and you look at the figures and you see things like, you know, turnover's gone up and stuff like that. It all looks pretty good. You look at different parts of the picture and it doesn't look quite so good either. But I mean, the bottom line, I suppose, is that profitability seems to have improved slightly. Our top 100 is done by an old Construction News colleague of mine, Stephen Mennery, who sort of plugged into all the sort of data providers in the industry. I mean, I suppose we could start off by saying there's no surprise, you know, the usual suspects at the top. So we've got, you know, Balfour Beatty and Keir and people like that.
Morgan Sindall, you have to mention, if you're talking about the top three. They're the top three.
Sorry, yes,
they?
Morgan Sindall, yeah. I was just looking at my notes and I hadn't put Morgan Sindall down there. Yeah, Keir, Waits, Lang O'Rourke, Mace, Morgan Sindall. Yeah, so they're all up there as usual. But yeah, the aggregate turnover, that's a turnover of the top 100. So basically, we look at the results filed at Companies House. We've got a cutoff point at the end of June to make sure that we've got everybody in the same sort of...
Unfortunately, some people have reported since June.
I know. So that's just the way it happens.
Yeah. There's always going to be that.
Yeah, our cutoff this year was the end of June. These top 100 firms turned over £76.5 billion. In the period we're looking at, which is actually 7.3% up compared to what it was last year. So that's a good thing.
And that's more than inflation and more than the economy's grown. So that's real growth, isn't it?
That's real growth. I mean, I suppose we ought to also say that it's not always the same 100 companies because, you know, some go up, some go down. And, of course, some disappear altogether. And, of course, ISG, which was one of the top 10 contractors when we last did our survey, it no longer exists. So they're out of the picture.
But just focusing on turnover for a minute, the fact that the top 100's turnover has grown by 7.5%, we think, oh, great. But on the other hand, it could mean that that's at the expense of, and we see this in house building all the time, the way that the big house builders are getting bigger and the smallers are getting smaller and disappearing and got more pressure. That could be at the expense of smaller guys. I mean, it doesn't mean, say, the industry's growing by 7.5%. It just means the big guys are growing by 7.5%. So I'm not quite sure what that tells us. But what about profitability? I mean, that's perhaps a more interesting number.
Well, overall pre-tax profits for this group of 100 firms went up 57%.
Wow.
Just over 1.9 billion.
There's your headline, 50%. Yeah. But then again, the year before was all sort of coming out of COVID and it was a really rubbish year the year before. It'd be interesting to compare, I suppose, these, it's broadly 2024, but a lot of these companies, it's still 2023 because they didn't...
Yes, that's true, yeah.
But it'd be interesting to see how that compares, not so much with the year before, but say 5 years before adding 5% for 10% for inflation or whatever you want to add.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, that can only be good news, can't it? 50%, 57% growth in pre-tax profits.
Yeah. Steve also looked at operating profit, of course, because, you know, that, I suppose you could argue that it gives a better idea of the actual value of the profitability because of, you know, it comes before exceptional items and all that kind of stuff. And operating profits are also up. Margins, I mean, some of, because we think about the construction sector, contractors particularly, having profit margins of about sort of 2 to 3%, some of them doing an awful lot better than that. It's interesting, usually it's the smaller companies or the specialist companies that get a better profit margin. The highest profit margin in the top 100 this year was Thomas Armstrong, not a firm I'm that familiar with, I have to confess. They've got an operating profit margin of 13.4%, which is pretty good.
That's very tight.
Pretty good. But then, you've got Henry Boot, which is a big contractor. I know a bit more about them. They've got a margin of 10.4%.
But they're a house builder more than a contractor.
They are a house builder. Yeah, they've got, yes. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's quite remarkable, really, that the profitability seems to have gone up so much.
But we've got the pre-tax margin, I note, from some of the notes I pulled out. It's gone, pre-tax profit margin has gone from 1.9 to 2.5, which is, I think they always used to talk about, to be, for benchmarking purposes, you wanted to have more than 2% margin.
Yeah.
2% is what you want, if not 3%. But, you know, anything less than 2% is a bit rubbish. So the fact that it's 2.4 is respectable.
It is. But you see, you know, I was saying just now that, it's a bit of a mixed bag. It depends how you look at these things, because we also look in our annual top 100, we look at profit warnings, which is, you know, obviously quite a useful sort of gauge of how things are likely to work out. There's been a massive surge in profit warnings this year. Yeah, they went up fourfold in the first half of this year, the number of companies warning that their profits aren't going to be what they were predicting they were going to be. So
it's a very small sample, though. I mean, it's gone fourfold from what, 2 to 8 or 3 to 12 or something? Because we're only talking about the listed companies who issue profit warnings.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's an indicator, but it doesn't scare me too much, that, especially when, you know, sometimes you get the same company putting out three. I mean, they're a house builder, not a construction company in this context, but Vistry put out three profit warnings within the space of 3 months at the back end of last year. three profit warnings. Well, it's actually one company just getting deeper in the mire.
Yeah, that's true. One thing which I think is a factor that's worth looking at is this question of delays in profits, in contract starts, actual things holding up output, in other words. And, you know, we've talked about this in the past, the building safety regulations and Building Safety Act, and this, you know, the gateway mechanism for high-rise buildings. That's slowed things down quite a lot certainly in the commercial, in the private sector.
You're quite right that the piece that Steve wrote, which is coming from the next issue of the magazine the top 100, quotes various commentators about the problems with the delays. But I've got more up-to-date information. We've just got Glenigan's latest report today.
Oh,
yes. On, today being Wednesday the 20th of August. But it's the three-month period, May to July, we've got starts, no, nosediving, both compared to the previous 3 months and year on year. We've got contract awards nosediving, and we've got planning approvals nosediving. All those three key major indicators for the 3 months to, to June or to July, to July, past 3 months basically, have all gone down. Starts have fallen by 20% over the previous 3 months, 17% year on year. Planning approvals gone by 55% quarter on quarter and 36% year on year. I mean, it's all pretty grim. And they previously say underlying contract. Glenigan talk about underlying contract awards, which basically they define as anything worth under £100 million in contract value, and then non-underlying or big contracts over £100 million. And the stuff under 100 million is sort of okay. It's not great, but sort of okay. It's tiddling along and maybe a little bit of growth. But the over 100, the big stuff, is where it's not happening. And, the building safety regulator is the backlogs there, which are supposedly easing somewhat or starting to get less bad, is a factor. But there's just so much hesitation in the market. It's all very, very worrying. Despite of all the great things that the game that the government's talking, and we're going to come on our next topic to talk about how the government's spending some money to try and put construction back on its, back storming and roaring again. But it all comes down to the private sector, and that's all about sentiment, really.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a little bit surprised that, you know, a lot of people talk about these, you know, this particularly Gateway 2, which is this barrier for starting the construction of high-rise buildings. I mean, that, yes, that certainly delays that sector, but high-rise buildings, how big is that sector as part of the construction industry? We're talking about high-risk buildings. This is all coming out of the the Grenfell Tower fire. And I think in
London, it's almost the entire residential building sector. You don't get many, you know, semi-detached three-bedroom family homes in London. It's all high. It's all 7 stories plus or whatever the figure is.
Yeah, so I suppose if that gets log-jammed, that does slow things down. I suppose it could sort of kick over into other areas as well, you know, if you get a log-jam like that in the system. But, I mean, what other factors could be delaying project starts? I mean, it can only be funding, can't it? Lack of money?
There's planning is an issue still.
That's always been a
I mean, if you talk about house building, you know, that side, it's the market, whether people have got money to buy houses. I mean, we know that house prices compared to salaries we used to be able to, you know, when you and I were starting our careers out and starting to think about, oh, can we buy a little flat somewhere? Used to get a mortgage of, you know, 2.5 times, 3 times your salary, and away you go, as long as you've got, you know, maybe $5,000 to put down or something. Now, way off, as you know, are your kids near to buying a house yet?
No. I mean, two of my kids are earning good money living in London. They're still living in rented accommodation. They can't get the deposit together. So, you know, it's I think a lot of people are in that sort of bind at the moment.
But then again, I think there's... In my day, young people today, I do get the impression that perhaps because our generation of parents are not as old as the previous generation of parents, and we're not as difficult to live with, perhaps, maybe. But 40 years ago, I couldn't wait, more than that, 45 years ago, I couldn't wait to leave home. If it meant living in a mouldy, crumbly bedsit, don't care. whereas I think there's a less enthusiasm to live in mouldy, crumbly bedsits over a 3 meals a day, laundry done, bank of mum and dad living at home.
Yeah, well, getting back to high-risk buildings, you know, you look at student accommodation these days, and of course it's, you know, there's a whole sector devoted to building high-rise buildings to accommodate students. Well, we didn't have that when you and I went to university. You probably did what I had to do, was find yourself a room in a terraced house in the local town. You know, that's what student accommodation was like back then. I mean, I was lucky, I suppose, in my first year, because I was on campus, so I was in sort of proper student accommodation. But now, I mean, you would put up with the most squalid conditions when you're a student, and when you're starting to look for somewhere to live as a professional, if you like, or in your working life, then you weren't so worried about living somewhere below.
But even after university, moved to London, you're living in a pretty squalid house share, you know, where every room is turned into a bedroom with bunk beds, possibly.
Yeah.
And when I did finally get to first time, but I couldn't buy on my own. You always have to buy with someone. My mother was terrified when my sister and I bought our first flat together with a shared mortgage. She thought it was all going to end in tears. Fortunately, it didn't. And within 2 years, I'd found someone better to live with. And we went our separate ways. But that was how, you know, starting off, getting on the ladder, was not buying my own place. It was a joint mortgage with someone.
And yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there are lots of people buying houses jointly today, or I shouldn't say houses, properties, flats, bedsits, whatever. But I think we were more desperate to escape the nest.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, going back to the top 100 and, you know, where things might lead in future, I mean, yeah, we've got this... The overall picture, if you look at the bottom line, you've got turnover up, you've got profitability up.
Oh yeah, we're talking about this.
We were talking about this.
Back on track. Well done, Dave.
So I got lost there because I was looking for some quotes that I couldn't find. I've made special notes about this and completely lost my way. But perhaps it's worth looking at some of the sectors where perhaps we might find workload increasing and demand increasing for some of these top 100 firms and, of course, their supply chains. And it's quite interesting because as we were putting together, there was actually the government announced that there was going to be, in fact, they quoted one of the construction data suppliers, Barber ABI. The BBC reported that there's going to be a massive increase in the amount of data centres being built because, of course, now everybody knows that AI is the coming thing, and we're all talking about AI and how it's going to transform our lives. And you can't do that without building these massive data centres. And I can't remember the number. In fact, I can probably find it. I saw
that BBC piece. Yeah, it's huge numbers. And we knew that, yeah.
Huge numbers of data centres about to be built. And in fact, in our top 100 commentary, we quote an analyst from a chap called Alastair Stewart from Progressive Equity Research.
He's another former construction journalist, isn't he, I believe?
I don't know. I recognise the name, Alastair Stewart.
I think he used to write for Building many years ago.
Possibly. Described as a veteran analyst anyway. So, I mean, he's obviously got some track record. But, I mean, he said... there is still work out there on data centres and defence. Defence as a sector, apparently, which is doing well, maybe because we've been told that we've got to increase our NATO contribution, so we're going to have to up our game when it comes to defence. But data centres, I think, is interesting because there's definitely something happening there. He says anything to do with power distribution, because that's incredibly, I'll quote him, anything to do with power distribution, as that's incredibly important as data centers are sucking up all the energy, and water is also important as data centers are not just sucking up power but need water as well. So that paints a sort of picture that we've got, this surge in data centers. I still can't remember how many they think they're going to have to build. Something like 50 new data centers. Well, they use a lot of energy and electricity, of course. So power distribution, that's already in the news as a contentious thing. The government says it wants to increase power distribution networks around the country. And water, so utilities. I think that's possibly where we're going to look for growth in the next few years.
Well, that's the whole world of infrastructure, the changing world of infrastructure today. Yeah. It's all about electricity and anything that supports the electronic IT world or whatever. Because, when we first started writing about construction, it's all about the road building program and motorway widening and whatever. And that is absolutely not a priority anymore. Okay, there are road projects to a certain extent, but it's not what it was. But that used to be the focus. And now it's... water's a big focus because water privatisation has absolutely failed. And so that's got to be all be fixed. So they've still got filthy rivers and whatever. But it's the data centres to support the cyber age.
Yeah, so I think that's going to be the area to look at for future growth. Housing, of course. The government's still talking about its 1.5 million new homes. In this parliament, and time is ticking by.
Now, one of the features of the top 100 in recent years has been what Company Watch, this, they're not a credit rating agency. What do we call
them? No, they're not.
A corporate health.
Yeah, they're analysts. They look at, I think that basically they're of particular interest to investors, because they'll show you, basically which firms look in robust health and are worth putting your money into, that kind of thing. But it's very useful from our point of view because it does give you a snapshot of how a company's trading, how well they're doing, what risks they might be running.
This is always interesting to see who's the financially the healthiest company and who's most likely to go pop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, so I need to bring this up then. So Company Watch... They do various different things, but they've got three sort of
algorithms,
basic,
aren't they?
Algorithms, yeah. Their main algorithm or their main measure is the H score, which I think is the most interesting one. And that is
H for health.
If you like, it's an overall health rating. And they score companies based on an analysis of their performance in their most recent results on a scale from 0 to 100. So,
and 100 is good.
And 100 is good, yes, definitely. In our top 100, the healthiest company, according to Company Watch H score anyway, is H.W. Martin Holdings with an H score of 93.
Who are they?
Yeah, exactly. I don't really know. I suppose I should have Googled them before we started recording this particular podcast. But H.W. Martin Holdings, obviously doing really, really well. They also come right at the top of the other of another Company Watch score, which is the probability of distress. This is where they calculate, based on the way things are going, the likelihood that the company is going to be experiencing some financial distress over the next 3 years.
Can I just rein you back? I'd hate to interrupt,
but
we shouldn't gloss over the Martin Group. I have just Googled them. They started out as a fencing contractor, and they've moved that to doing traffic management, road restraint systems, waste recycling, vehicle and plant maintenance. So they're not, I mean, they're a contractor, but they're not a construction contractor that you might think of them. They're more like...
Yeah, they've got their...
In the same way...
They've got several strings to their bow, haven't they?
Another company which has become... is getting increasingly bigger and bigger and is in the top 10 is M Group, what used to be Morrison Utilities.
Yes.
Which were, it's a utility contractor, but there's all sorts of other little things. But we won't see them, for example, building new motorways or high buildings or nuclear power stations. They're, generally speaking, well, certainly H. Martin, are very much sort of tier three, I guess, in lots of different ways.
Well, it's interesting that you should make that observation, because if you look at the companies that do that sort of work, some of those are amongst the ones with the lowest H score. Lang O'Rourke with an H score of 8. Integral UK, also at 8.
Lang O'Rourke have had a score of under 10 for quite a few years.
They have.
5 years. And they've
Lang O'Rourke are back in profit, apparently. They've been trading at a loss.
Operating
the last
profit.
They still made
a pre-tax loss, but that's because of, if memory serves, I think there was a Australian legacy problem still.
Yes.
Or whatever. So, they're certainly trading at a profit, and I think we're going to see them come around.
Yeah, but I mean, again, alongside people like Lang O'Rourke, you've also got Bouygues UK and Tilbury Douglas. Traditional contractors, by our estimation, they've got H scores of 13% and 15%.
And anything under 25 is kind of the danger zone.
Yes. So 25 is the, they call it the danger zone or warning area. H.W. Martin at the top with 93, and actually United Living Group is got the lowest H score of 7. United Living Group, they do. What?
I think of them as more housing maintenance, social housing maintenance.
Yes, which I wouldn't have thought would be a particularly tricky area to be in, but maybe it is. I would have thought building maintenance was, you always need somebody to come and
less
fix
risk.
The roof kind of thing. Yeah, exactly. No, interesting, but you've got, in fact, if you look at the top five companies by H score, they're exactly the same top five companies by probability of distress. So they've got the lowest probability of distress. I mean, H.W. Martin Holdings, their probability of distress is 0.067%. So that sounds pretty,
absolutely
pretty secure
safe.
To me.
Yes.
But H.W. Martin Holdings, Stanmore Contractors, F.P. McCann, they're concrete people, aren't they?
Precasting and products.
Yes, precast concrete. There is a third measure that Company Watch uses, which I think is quite interesting, although it's not available for all the companies in the top 100, and that's their text score. And this is a measure that they use based on an analysis of the language used in their annual report. So they use, AI, which creeps into everything these days. They use this machine learning algorithm to scan the language used by the company when reporting their financial results, and then comparing that with the language used by companies which subsequently got into difficulties, which I think is a rather subtle way of looking at a company.
So if you sound like ISG, Buckingham or Interserve, you're heading that way.
Yeah, exactly. It's very, very strange. I mean, it seems to suggest that there's some sort of subliminal effect happening here, that people trying to put a gloss on perhaps less than sparkling results tend to resort to the same sort of language.
But language changes, though, doesn't it? I mean, jargon changes.
Well, of course, yeah, it does. Yeah. But it suggests to me that this algorithm that Company Watch uses can pick up on this language and say, they're trying, when they're saying this, what they actually mean is that. So I don't know. I don't know how reliable that is. But let me say, you do get different people in the top five and the bottom five by tech score compared to the ones in the probability of distress and H score boxes. I mean, Hill Holdings has the highest, followed by Lindham Group, Caddick, John Graham Holdings, and Balmer and Kirkland, who of course are a house builder, aren't they? Lowest tech scores: Enoveo, Ardmore Construction, Durkin Holdings, Gilbert Ash, and Stanmore Contractors.
This is where I worry about the that particular metric, the tech score thing.
Yeah.
Because if you look at someone like Gilbert Ash, I mean, their H score is 59. I mean, yeah. they're saying that they've got a really, you know, got they're a strong company. I mean, they've got, you know, no debt, £30 million, £29 million net worth, and, you know, reasonable profit. £2 million, well, actually, no, not very strong profits, but they make a profit on, you know, 260-odd million sales. I mean, they're a perfectly decent company who do fantastic projects, including the National Portrait Gallery refurbishment, which
it's
been on my to-do list for the past 2 years since it reopened. I still haven't got there, so I must do that, but I've seen pictures of it.
But you see, maybe Gilbert Ash just talked themselves down. Maybe that's what it boils down to.
I'm allowed to say this because I'm married into a Northern Irish family, but it would be racist for anyone else to say it, that the Northern Irish can sound, you know, can be a bit glass half empty sometimes.
Well, yeah, maybe it's as simple as that. I mean, this is based on the language used in their annual results, so maybe they just ought to, you know, get in an image consultant to rewrite their stuff and saying, we did quite nicely last year.
Yes. They don't need to do that.
Record profits.
No, but they don't need to do that unless people take the tech score thing too seriously. I think it's interesting to look at, and it might be, why should we look at that? But the actual numbers, the things that matter. I mean, I'm only looking at Gilbert Ash here. I've got no comment on the others. I'm sure they're the same.
No.
There's no evidence of, just because they might have used some Carillion-style buzzwords.
True. I mean, I think it is true because Company Watch also collaborate with us when we do our bi-monthly sector focus, where we look at the top 20 contractors from a particular sector of the industry. They also contribute the metrics for those as well. And I often notice that the tech score doesn't necessarily correlate with, for example, the H score. A company with a good H score might score quite badly on its tech score. So I think you have to take it probably with a pinch of salt. I think that the tech score is interesting because it might tell you something about what the company is thinking rather than the way they're doing. You know, if they're a little bit reticent in blowing their own trumpet, maybe they know something that hasn't been revealed to everybody else. I don't know. I think that you have to just look at it and say that's interesting, because it is quite interesting, but not necessarily
significant
as a hard and fast measure of how this company is doing. I think the H score and the probability of distress, which are based on analysis of actual figures, and I think far more easy to quantify, they're the real metrics that you really ought to be looking at, I think.
Should we move on?
Yeah, let's move on.
No, we talked about the I mentioned before, Glenigan are saying all the industry indicators are heading downwards, and the government has, since it came in more than a year ago, has been looking to construction and infrastructure to drive economic growth, and particularly house building, 1.5 million pounds, 1.5 million new homes or housing units. It's talking about over the lifetime of the parliament. We know that's not going to happen, but there's still there. It's a real priority for them. And as part of that, they recognise well, another priority, particularly if they're, you know, looking to the threat of the Nigel Farage Reform Party, is to reduce immigration, not just the boats, but actual net immigration as well, which is just, I mean, the boats is a sideshow in the whole story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The actual legal immigration numbers are huge and, and just continue to get
far more significant.
It's huge. And a lot of it is because we don't have the people for the health service and for other services, including construction. And this is because we're not training enough of our own people. And they've had a big push on trying to promote construction training. And last week we had, or the week before possibly, but since we last spoke, David, there was an announcement, and I'll have a look at it, 12th of August, the Department for Education press release headline, 40,000 people to get skills in new technical excellence colleges. And it says that they're setting up these new colleges backed by £100 million investment, and they're going to train 40,000 people.
Yeah, you weren't impressed.
Well, no, it's great. I'd much rather they spend £100 million in construction training than don't. Yeah. I wasn't impressed by the presentation of it. First of all, this is the exact same announcement that was made in March by the Chancellor when she said she was going to allocate £100 million of new investment for 10 technical excellence colleges. But these aren't new colleges. These are existing colleges. 10 of the dozens of further education colleges in the country. 10 of them are getting a share of this £100 million pot. This £100 million pot is £80 million for capital spending, £20 million for revenue spending, to expand their ability or their capacity to train construction students, take construction courses. And my immediate reaction was, why only those 10? Because there's so many. Why not, you know, a bit for more? Is that the right thing? And the idea is that they're giving these 10 colleges, including, for example, obvious ones like the, you know, Leeds College of Building, which is a specialist building college. You say, right, you're now a centre of excellence in your area. You'll have to lead the drive for training in your area, work with other colleges in your area. But it struck me, I mean, one of them is Sunderland, say, for an example. Sunderland College is now what was the jargon? A technical excellence college for construction. But Newcastle isn't. Now, if I'm a young person in the, you know, Wearside, Tyneside, between the two places, I'd think, well, Sunderland's obviously the, you know, it's the Cambridge or Oxford of construction training. I'm going there rather than the, you know, Lampeter Polytechnic that is Newcastle now. And so it seems to be pitting one against it. It's kind of fair, but that, apparently that's not, it's supposed to be all boats rise on a rising tide or whatever, all boats float on a rising tide.
Because these new CTECs, they describe them as hubs, don't they?
That's the idea. But
you've got spokes going out to.
But the spokes are their competitors. Colleges compete for students.
Yes.
Now, some colleges are in a network, so you might have a college which is in the same educational company or group as other colleges, so they can work as a network.
Yeah.
But others compete with each other, I believe. I'm not an expert on further education structures and fundings, but I'm slightly perturbed how they will. Anyway, it's still, at least it's good that Sunderland is going to have more capacity. My next problem is, it's kind of working on the "if you build it, they will come" premise. That if Sunderland suddenly has a really, really whizzy new building or whizzy new trowels to put in the hands of its training bricklayers rather than the dirty second-hand trowels it was using before, and shiny new cement mixers and mortarboards and everything, that will make young people go, I want to go to study bricklaying because Sunderland College has got great new facilities. I don't think that's going to make young people want to study bricklaying just because the college has got great new facilities.
No, that's true.
Do it. Possibly the only way to get, not the only way, the best way to get young people to study these things, yes, it's all the things which we've been doing for years with Go Construct, is it? The careers guidance website. It's outreach. It's doing the schools visits, which contractors appear to be doing left, right and centre. But at the end of the day, it's at the top end, the pull is, are they going to get a job and decent pay? And the dropout rate from colleges is huge, or between colleges and starting, or they might start work, or they might be on an apprenticeship and not follow through. There's a structural problem there, which I'm not completely on top of to suggest any answers, but I'm sure people are.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, for young people going to college, they'll either say, I want to do something that's fun and interests me, or they might think, I want to do something that's going to be good for, in my future career.
Yes.
And it's the latter way you hope people might do construction courses, and a lot are, but not enough are.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of think, wouldn't it be better, by which I mean more effective, just to say to any young person who is over the age of 17, if you go to this college and study a construction course, we'll give you a five-year-old Volkswagen Polo or something, plus insurance, and if you haven't got a driving test, we'll pay for your driving lessons. Something concrete and firm that, I mean, no one's supposed to be encouraging people to get behind the wheel of their car, but actually stick something in their hand, say, and the moment you drop out, you lose the car.
Yeah, I mean, some sort of incentive. I mean, there was one of the previous Conservative governments introduced that incentive. I can't remember what they called it, but they basically gave people who wanted to train as teachers a golden handshake, didn't they?
Yeah.
Because basically we haven't got any teachers. And was it Teach First? I think they introduced something like that. Some sort of inducement like that.
It's got to be money, but money you can't take away from them. A car you can take away from them.
That's true. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that is. What would it be? I don't know. A Rolex, perhaps.
No, or, but the point is about a car is that they can get to work. They've got no excuse. Or maybe just free travel, free train and bus travel or something.
I think that could be
something
workable.
Of value that will make that. I'm going to do that because that will make my life better. And if you're 17, you've got a car.
Yeah,
got it
absolutely.
Made.
Absolutely. I can't think of a precedent for that, though, giving cars away to people in return for them choosing a certain career. But I think, maybe free travel.
My first year at university, the only people who had cars were people who were being sponsored by either on Army or Navy, military placements, or maybe a few were on placements from banks or something, but industrial placements. They had the cars. And then they were tied to this. Well, you've got to then go do whatever it is, 3 years in the forces after graduation or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Well. Yeah. It's an idea. It's definitely an idea. I certainly agree with you that if somebody doesn't actually want a career in construction, it doesn't matter how shiny and new their local education college is. They're not going to go there.
No.
They're going to choose something else. I don't know. Maybe
free beer.
This. Free beer.
At Leeds College of Building, they have free beer. That'll do it.
Yeah, I'm sure it would. Whether or not that would produce the workforce that we really, really need, I don't know.
It's good. It builds you up. It's full of carbs.
But if they throw the money at these colleges, and presumably some of it will be going into recruitment and hiring new staff in order to actually deliver more and better training.
Well, we do know. We had someone on a couple of years ago, forgive me, I cannot remember your name, but who had moved from industry to education. And there was a big drive on, because I want more people from the industry, actual proper you know, traders to go and teach future traders. And there's a shortage of those. So there is an element of teacher shortage, which maybe this money can help tackle. But I don't think that's the industry's pinch point. You know, it's not the shortage of teachers. It's the shortage of applicants, I think, is the bigger problem.
Yeah. Yes, I agree. I think that's absolutely true. Yeah. So I don't know whether we'll see. I mean, this is just the latest announcement, although, as you said, it's the latest, but it's been announced before. Well, I was going to say, the government make the point that this builds on the £625 million investment announced in March, which will separately be used to train up to 60,000 more skilled construction workers by 2029.
Well, this is my other problem with the news story of last week about these new construction technical centres of, what are they called? Construction Technical Excellence Colleges. They're not new. It's just a new badge that they've got.
Yes.
I suppose what is new is the model, that the idea of being hub and spoke. But there was no detail on that. So they didn't really give us anything on that.
It was a bit like Boris Johnson and all his hospitals.
Yeah, exactly. You know. Yes, yes.
Our
yes,
new hospital, yes. All these 40 new hospitals Absolutely. We're building, actually.
It's the same old... The government information machinery is absolutely appalling, and it has been for years. But it's yes, as you're saying yourself, it's the fact that it's another announcement. Is this 100, is it new, or is it on top of the
I thought it was part of the
625 announced in the spring statement.
Yeah, so that's only training up 60,000, not 40,000. So I mean, 60, that's 20,000 more, but it's six times as much in terms of funding. I don't understand.
So it's all the messaging is not clear, and they don't help it by the fact they keep repeating the same thing, and you can't think, is that new or is that not new? So it's all a bit of a mess. But anyway, the bottom line is, it's the people we want to come into the industry, and the people in the industry, we got to start treating better or nurturing financially as much as anything else, which leads us on
very neatly. Very neatly. I know what you're going to say.
We reported this week that Stoke-on-Trent City Council, the craft workers, or the blue-collar workers there, the joiners, plumbers, electricians, all the people that look after council houses and council buildings, 225 of them, they get 2 days less annual leave a year than all the office drones that work for the council.
Yeah.
So if you're white collar, you get two extra days, regardless of your, you know, skill level, salary level, years of service, whatever. If you're blue collar, you're subhuman and you don't get as much holiday. You're just treated like rhubarb.
It's that is astonishing. I'm amazed that that happens.
And it may not just be Stoke. It may happen everywhere. I don't know. But it's Stoke on Trent. They've voted to take strike action. 99%.
Yeah.
I don't know what the other two people were thinking of, but 99% of 225 were striking. And two of them presumably got lost on their way to work or were off sick that day or whatever. The union regional official Asif Mohammed says, "Our members are increasingly angry at the dismissive and anti-union attitude of their department leaders." I don't think it's anti-union attitude. I think it's just an anti-blue collar attitude.
I mean, giving them the benefit of the doubt, it might be an oversight, an administrative oversight, that the office workers have been given a certain amount of, maybe they've used some sort of off-the-shelf pro forma recruitment or contract of employment, which has X number of days holiday a year for office staff, and they've got a different form for craft workers, and it's just that they haven't actually compared the two and noticed that there's a discrepancy.
Well, maybe they're following a national agreement for the craft workers, and that's standard. What the craft workers at Stoke-on-Trent get is what craft workers get everywhere, because that was all, you know, negotiated by their union. And maybe the white collar workers have just been given something extra, which is, as you say, they've got to give to whatever. But it just cuts to the way in which, another way in which becoming, you know, working in construction trades is less attractive than, you know, sitting at a desk all day.
Well, in this case, it certainly is, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, this, as you say, this, general, was it the General Secretary, Sharon Graham, who said this, or their local officer? Yeah. You know, these people go out in all weathers, risking physical injury every day, you know, whereas the office workers, they might trip over a waste paper basket or something. And that's at least, you know, the worst of their problems. It does seem...
The only counter-argument might be that I bet the maintenance crews get more opportunity to earn overtime and might be able to bump up their pay quite a lot. But I'm not sure that is enough. You know, I think that is separate from the whole annual leave conversation.
Well, I think that's pretty mean, actually, to say, well, you know, you could get more overtime, therefore you're going to have less holiday. You know, you only get the overtime if the work needs to be done.
Yeah. Yeah.
If somebody says you've got a leak in this flat, you're going to go and do it, and you get paid overtime to do it.
Yeah, I was trying to find a defense, and I can't.
No, I think basically somebody's made a mistake somewhere, and that everybody should be getting the same amount of holiday. And it seems like an easy fix to me. Just take 2 days away from the office workers.
And four from the bosses.
Yeah.
Good plan. Right. I think that's us for okay. another session, David. It'll be It'll be September next time we speak.
I know.
It'll still be sunny.
Well, yeah, apparently so.
It will.
Yeah,
fabulous.
It will be. Yes, I hope so anyway.
Right.
All right then, Phil.
Thank you for listening. Hey, if anyone's got a solution to the skills shortage, the skills crisis, the problems we have getting people into the industry, tell us and we'll tell everyone else. podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk And as I've asked before, apparently, if you leave us a review or stars or something wherever you listen to your podcast, it will mean that other people can find our podcast better and hear about us and join us. So that would be fabulous as well. But as it is, it's goodbye from me and it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye from me.
Yeah. Cheerio.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.